is the seventh in the series of quarantine conversations in the age of COVID-19. I'm very pleased and honored to be here with someone I've known for quite some time. His name is Roger. He is the lead singer of Agnostic Front. He's also an author. He is a father and probably has found himself back in school, so to say, because of the pandemic. So, Roger, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am the current and been the lead singer for the New York hardcore punk band Agnostic Front since I joined the band in 1983. I mean, who joins a band in 83 and stays in it? I did that. And I travel the world and I get to, you know, see a lot of awesome places, meet a lot of good people. And it's actually not only just fun, it's been something I've been committed to and I love very much and I adore.
What's it like having to find yourself teaching your children their school subjects now that you're home, you're not on tour, and I'm sure they enjoy that you're home. I'm sure you enjoy it too. What do you find that's the most challenging about quote-unquote going back to school?
It's great. You know, it's great. I'm spending a lot of very necessary time with my children and with my wife. It's the one good thing about it, if there is any good thing about it, is that I get to spend some quality family time and I get to spend time at home. And I mean, even our pets are a little confused. They're not used to seeing me around this long, or us just being in indoors. We've been indoors since last month on the 11th. We haven't left our home. Luckily, we have a yard, and that's about it. You know, I'll go out for the necessary prescriptions. My wife and my son live with a compromised immune system, and whatever little foods I need to get, but I'm very protected, very, you know, very careful. But the rest of my family is our home. School was fun. It's new. It's challenging. Algebra never was so difficult in my life. And that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, I can imagine that algebra would be something that you probably haven't even thought of or even looked at for years, and then you're now having to deal with it.
Yeah, let me tell you something. I don't know if this is anything like homeschooling. I don't think it is. I think this is, it's really extreme, whatever's going on. It's a lot. Because it's you know, like me, myself, and my wife was reading a book to help my daughter. It's a 4-hour lesson book. She read at the same time my daughter was reading it, just to help her through her studies. Like, it's a lot of work, but if we don't know what's going on, we can't help. We can't, like, get in and be like, okay, so remember this in the book? Remember this, you know? So it's a lot. It's a lot. We're actually doing a teaching job over here as the work keeps coming out. The school district here has not stopped in the Scottsdale. The school system here in Arizona has been very persistent about getting their work done, getting it all together, and it's happening.
Your kids, are they in middle school now, or are they just going to start middle school, your oldest?
One is in middle school right now. She's a sixth grader, seventh grader. My son, who's a fifth grader, about to start middle school next year, too. He'll be a sixth grader. I'll have my oldest, who's up in California, but she's all grown up and doing her thing.
When I first met you and we became, you know, we became to know each other, became friends, Your oldest was young at the time, and I was a little taken aback when I'm like, wait, she's how old now?
How old am I? Exactly. Didn't we do a show together somewhere in Massachusetts?
Yeah, we did, but that was after Punk Rock Bowling, because then I then had gotten in touch with you and asked if you were around and you guys could play, and then I was then put in touch with Deborah. So that was after Punk Rock Bowling. And that was one of the best shows I ever did back in Western Massachusetts, was the announcement.
Yeah, that's where it was. That was a fun show. I remember that. I was also traveling with my daughter, or maybe
No, it was your whole family. You were with your wife and your two kids.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun for sure.
It was. Somebody I just was in touch with attended that show. And we were just talking about it about 3 days ago. I forgot who it was. I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was the most people I ever got into that club. There was no security, no problem. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. We enjoyed it too.
What would you have been doing now? What was on the calendar for this time pre-pandemic? What was the band doing, or what were you going to be doing at this time?
Well, right now we're supposed to be on a tour on the East Coast with Sick of It All, and it was supposed to start, I think, April 20th, to be, if I remember correctly, and it was going to kick through into Canada. Today we probably would have been in Canada, and then kind of circle around through kind of the center Midwest, up hit like Chicago, then down through Texas and scoop back up. And in this tour, there were two big festival dates with Metallica on both dates and numerous bands. And it was also the Black and Blue Festival. We were supposed to headline on the very last date. So that's all kaput.
What would you say would be the most, like, when you have been touring and you got to go places you probably never thought of, never dreamed about seeing when you were, you know, joining the band in the initial stages, like, I'm sure you didn't imagine it would go as long as it has.
No, but I didn't. I'm lucky and you for real, you know, because I got to join a band and be with a bunch of friends of mine that we were just doing it because we're screaming for a change. We wanted to say something. We wanted to be heard. And then we put everything we wanted to say, wanted to be heard, onto records. And that got me to travel the world. And it wasn't just a calling from New York. It just happened to be that people all over the world in all different places were feeling what we were feeling. I mean, we've always spoken about oppression and overcoming oppression, you know, uniting together to do these things, you know what I mean? So it was like a calling, you know, it was a lucky thing and a great thing because it got me to travel the world. Like I say that I tell everybody that what I'm doing now is I'm living my retirement, you know, and still to this day, there's going to be a point where for some reason or matter, we're going to have to stop. But till then, I'm enjoying having the time of my life.
When you first played in a furthest most place that you had played at the time, like let's say, you know, the first time that you were out of New York playing a show in another country far from New York, when you saw people sing your lyrics back to you, how did that make you feel?
It felt great. Especially, you know, like our first like U.S. tour, for example, the farthest we ever went was like the West Coast, obviously. Up as north as Portland, played a phenomenal show up there with Poison Idea and Lockjaw. That was great. And as south as Southern California, where we did the Olympic Auditorium, the notorious show where Huge Riot, which was Exploited, Us, Dr. No, Don't Know, UK Subs. It was a phenomenal show. And that was just America, you know. Then all of a sudden, you know, it's time to trench, go across the ocean into Europe. And that was a whole different thing because, you know, you have a bunch of people speaking a different language you don't even know and gathering to watch us perform. And as soon as we start playing, they're singing along. They're singing all the backups. They're just having a time of their life. And it was almost like there was no more barrier, nothing between us. You know what I mean? Like there was one common thing and it was hardcore punk. Until then, we had nothing in common besides the love of the music. And then we play. Now a lot of us have become friends for life.
What are some of the favorite places that you've gone to perform out of the country?
We love Germany. Germany's been like, especially like Berlin, it's like a second home to us. That's where our crew is. That's where a lot of our friends are. But we love everywhere in Europe for sure. South America is amazing. We've gone into Asia. That's also amazing. There's a lot of great places to go. But if anything, because our extended crew is out in Europe, especially in Germany, it feels good to go there and and, you know, kind of hang out with them, break bread, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Has there been a place that you have on your bucket list that you haven't gone to yet, or have you hit pretty much everywhere there is to play at this point?
There's a couple of places on my bucket list. It's just like, you know, they're like, I've always wanted to go to Egypt just to see the pyramids, to be honest with you, and perform, of course. There's a lot of places that, you know, I don't know what we could do anymore. Like, I've always wanted to go to Israel or that area, but then you have so much animosity between a lot of people, and you know, I don't want to pick any favorites or any sides, you know what I mean? We're just a band, you know, but unfortunately things fall that way. We played Istanbul. That was a phenomenal show. That was a great time. I love Russia. We've done a bunch of shows in Russia. It's been great times. Let me see. If I wanted to go anywhere right now that I haven't gone to, you know, like state-wise, I haven't gone to Alaska or Hawaii. South America-wise, Brazil and Argentina and Chile. Chile's phenomenal. Mexico's a great time. Canada's a great time. In Asia, of course, Japan's a great time. Let me see. Indonesia was awesome. Where else did we go on that last tour? We went to Bangkok. Was awesome. Really awesome. There's so many great places. Where do I need to? Where would I like to go? Somewhere exotic. Like, take me to Peru. I want to see stuff now. I want to see Machu Picchu. But I don't think there's anywhere to play there, if you know what I mean. But that's kind of where my head is. My head is there. You know, I'd love to go to South Africa, too. There's places I haven't been to that I'd like to go. But I just want to see a little bit more right now.
Sure, of course. And have you played in Cuba, or have you gone there yourself?
Well, I should have said that, of course, but I would love to return to Cuba, of course, and play, but that is a big problem. I attempted it. There was a show booked and everything, and I even went to the Cuban consulate in Washington, D.C. They said it was going to be no problem. We got our airline tickets. We're actually, I don't know if you're familiar with our film, The Godfathers. It was supposed to end with us playing in Cuba. Like, here's a story about a kid that left Cuba, you know, which is myself, you know, and moved to New York with my family. And now I'm returning and playing a show there. That's an incredible story, you know. And they wouldn't let me in. My mom, so the whole film crew and the rest of the band, just like, what's, you know, we might as well just not go at this point. And this is 2 days before, you know, we were supposed to even go. They all got their visas to go. And they denied me, my mom, and my brother. And I was like, well, there goes that. So unfortunately, till things get a little bit better, of course I would love to go there. We have a decent fan base out there, believe it or not. I've got friends. I actually bought a band from Cuba to play the Black and Blue Ball once. It was awesome, Arabio. We played with them in Canada, and we had a great time. Great connections, and they're like, hey, we had like an exchange, like, you know, you come to New York, play a show, blah blah blah, then we'll go to Cuba. Well, they came to New York, they played, it was great, and it's not their fault that, you know, we could make it into Cuba.
The Cuban government was going to let Stigma in, but not you, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. You figure that out, huh? Stigma was happy. He was so excited. He couldn't wait to go to Cuba and smoke Cuban cigars and just hang out. To him, it was just a beautiful thing to see me go back to where I was born, you know? So someday.
Well, let's hope someday for sure. Absolutely. You were talking about the film, The Godfathers of Hardcore, and how was that to make? Like, was it something that you had planned on for a while, or were you approached to do it, or was this something that you set out to do?
We were approached to do it by the director, Ian McFarlane. We were approached to do this back in 2005, and we started it, and we did like a mini clip thing, which turned out to be a live performance with 20-minute interview. It was so good. The whole recording was done at CBGB. It was a whole live recording. And then the interviews that we kind of decided, let's just release this live at CBGB's DVD and audio, and then a 20-minute like interview thing, which was really cool. It was awesome. But then Ian came back around somewhere around 2011, maybe something like that. No, that's maybe 2013 or 14. And he reapproached, and we were like, hey, yeah, we've just been waiting. So all he asked from us is for us to just be ourselves. He was going to come live with me for a week. Just be me. Do nothing but just be me. Just be me. And the same thing with Vinny. And then collectively, they came on a row with us. And he put that all together. It was really all done by him. We had no input whatsoever besides ourselves and our performances and whatever stuff. I gave him a bunch of stuff that was in my own personal archives. Historical stuff and stuff to help with the film, and it was really just all him. He did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, it's great. It was really nice to see. We're getting to the point in the history of the music that we've all been involved with that a lot of bands are doing sort of retrospective projects, whether it be a book or a documentary. And the book is great. It's one of my favorite books that I've read. I've stopped reading pretty much all fiction. I've been trying to read more nonfiction or biographies because I find that they're the most interesting and certainly something that you could always find something relatable in them. It was great. Who approached you about it, or was this something that you always wanted to do as well?
The book. Wow, that's a whole other story, man. I started this book, 1998 or 1999, and I was in a studio with Lars Fredriksson from Rancid. We were recording our second album for Epitaph, Riot Riot Upstart, and we were just going over, talking about the past, talking about stories. He goes, man, Roger, you got to do a book. And he goes, we're going to start right now. Right now, we're starting this book. And we did. He sat down with a tape player. And we just started telling stories and going. And I was like, well, this is not that bad. And I'm not really good at typing or anything like that. So then what happened was I started doing a lot of work in the studio with a lot of bands, doing production work. And in exchange, I was talking into this machine, into like a tape recorder. But it was all these weird hard drives back then. And in exchange from my time, I asked, one of the members to type out everything I was saying, kind of like all my memos, you know what I mean? And that's how it all started. And I have these original floppy disks, right? Then September 11th came around, and because it's September 11th, you want to know what was going on. So it corrupted my computer, and it corrupted both my laptop and my computer, so it all got deleted. Everything else I added to the original floppy disk, which I still have. But now all that work just went away. I was like, oh, so frustrated. And that was, 2011. Then I bought a program called Naturally Speaking Dragon to start all again. And I had to teach my phone my voice, and that took a whole month of training my audio voice into my computer and into my phone. And then something happened again, and I got another virus, and I lost it all. And that's when I switched to Macs, by the way. Around 2015, I switched to a Mac, and then I put everything together one more time. And I was doing an interview with this other guy. And he goes, let me see what you got. And I show him everything. He goes, wow, this is amazing. He goes, it's a little all over the place, because it really was. It was just me going on. He goes, let me help you edit it. Let me help you put it together. And then, see if you like it. So I let him do that. And it came out great. We kind of edited. He edited it, and it was really cool. It was like the first edit. He goes, I think this is phenomenal. I'd love to help you out. His name was John. So we don't. And then I'm like, no, this is something I really want to do on my own. I've been doing it for so long. I need to do this on my own. So fast forward, another 2 years go by. And of course, I didn't get around to it because I'm on the road. I'm doing a million things. He's like, I really want to help you. Let me help you. So I said, okay, let's do it. And he started interviewing me, filling in the blanks. And the story just kept growing. And I was like, wow, this is great. And he was just apparently going to be, he goes, I just want, he just wanted a credit for editing credit, but he did so much. I was like, I can't do that. You, if it wasn't for you, the book wouldn't be done, wouldn't be where it was. It went through three giant edits, you know what I mean? And you were a part of helping me finish this, and that's, you're in it with me. It was definitely my story, something I started with, something I began with, something I'm really proud of. But if it wasn't for John, I probably would have never seen Dave, you know what I mean?
I get that completely. Well, you guys did a great job, that's for sure.
And you know what's really cool about it too is that I never wanted to go as far as it did. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have gone, because I had the story stopping around Cause for Alarm. kind of wanted to do it in three different books, see how it goes. But if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have been pushed forward to even. I didn't even want to talk about certain things that happened after Crossroad One was released, like my time in an all expense government expense paid vacation and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm kind of glad that we, you know, he let me open that, you know, which was, it was cool, and I really did everything for my family, you know, so just so their history is there. That's all.
Would you say that the time away and the all expense paid government, what did you call it, vacation home village, was more challenging, or this time was more challenging for having a band?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, you couldn't have a band. I mean, I did have a couple bands when I was on my vacation, but they were different style bands. It's definitely the most challenging thing that has ever happened to me in my life. It was another eye-opening experience. I didn't know how selfish I was, and it was all about me. And that made me realize that the people I was hurting that really cared about me, besides people in the scene, all my own, you know, my daughter, my own family, all the other hurt and stuff I was doing for people I never even knew. So in a way, it was an eye-awakener. It was great. It gave me fire to want to come out and do more with the band. And that's when I wrote all that. That's the only record that we have that's a whole theme, is the One Voice record that followed up after that experience. The whole theme is that, is one theme. The whole record has to do with that situation, which is incredible. It's like my wall, or the Who Quadrophenia, you know, it's just one giant story, that whole LP. And you know, and it gave me a lot of drive to move forward in a different positive mentality, you know what I mean?
That makes total sense. For the time that the band was not active, which was how many years between, what records in your discography was the band inactive?
It was inactive between Liberty and Justice and One Voice, even though that live record came out, the most, our classic live at CBGB is the first one. That was released while I was away, and we never toured anything for it, but that's like one of the most classic live records, period, or one of our most, you know, people love that record. The live at CBGB is the one with the flag and the boots, you know? And then there was another time between 1990, which is another live at CBGB's record, which we made last two, which between 1992 and 1997, or that I just needed a break, and I wanted to spend time with my family, that we weren't active at all. But then Vinny was active with Madball and doing a bunch of other stuff. The rest of the guys all were active with Madball. It's kind of like they went and took that off, you know?
Vinny has definitely carved out a character for himself, not only in the hardcore scene, but just everywhere. I'm sure he's a very well-known figure in New York. I've never seen him in New York, aside from when I lived there. And I don't think he was as colorful as a character as he is now back then.
I don't know about that. I think he's always been, I don't see much difference in him. Vinny's a very happy person. You know, Vinny's one of those guys that he's done the crazy things in the world, you know? Like, he'll talk to anybody. He'll talk to a dog if this dog's sitting next to him. he's that kind of a guy, man. He, you know, it's always been him, the easier, approachable person in the band. And I'm a little bit, I've always been more reserved or more introverted, you know what I mean? So people always approach me more with a little bit more caution because they don't know how I am, what I'm doing, or how I'm feeling. It's just that I've always been a little, that's who I am. I've always been a little bit more reserved. Now Vinny will go in there. He just met you and within 20 minutes, it's like you knew this guy your whole life.
I find him just, I think in the age of video, I think I see him more as a character.
Yes.
Pre-video, there really wasn't much. You'd have to see him. You'd have to catch him. You'd have to catch him where he was. Whereas on video, that's his platform.
Yes. And you know what it is? He's a character. I tell everybody he's my Eddie from Iron Maiden. you know, but he's actually real. He's got a guitar. He's running around, you know, where Eddie is just the figure in the back, you know? So, he is who he is. He's definitely one of a kind. Let's just say that mold was broken after birth.
You had mentioned that your wife and your son both have compromised immune system. So when you woke up the next day after it was announced that pretty much everything was shutting down as we knew it, life had kind of come to a stop or at least a pause. What were you dealing with when you had to go out to the store to get something from the pharmacy or from the market?
I went in like I'm going into war, man. I mean, it was really surprising to see that, you know, the very first time I went out, I had, you know, glasses, mask, gloves, and everybody else is looking at me like, well, it was like insane. And the only one that didn't happen is when I went obviously to the health food grocery shop here, Sprouts. And those people that were in there were a little bit more protected, but not as much as they are now. But I was like, man, like, why aren't people really taking this serious? You know what I mean? And it seems out the more I go out now, the more serious. But at first, it was just like, I look like a freak. And back then, when I was a kid and looked like a freak, I had a big mohawk, red mohawk and no eyebrows. This time, I just was like a normal looking freak with a mask. but I had to do what I had to do, and I came home. I showered right away, threw my clothes in the laundry because you know I care and love for my family, you know. And last thing I want to do is bring something back where I'm going to be in a worse situation. So it's those little simple steps that sometimes you need to take, and just because you care for others, for the greater of mankind, for the greater of other people, and stop looking at us like, oh, this can't do nothing to me. I'm young, I'm healthy, I go to the gym, blah blah blah. It's not about you. The world does not evolve around you. The world evolves around a lot of people. All the respect, all the stuff that our mothers and grandparents did for us and for some of these people act like, it's like, well, I'm not old. It's not going to happen to me. Well, someday you will be. I hope your children never behave that way. Because, you know, I have nothing but out of respect for my elders. Always have. You know, I loved hearing all those old stories back then. I loved hearing all the old war stories, which I don't get to hear that much anymore. A lot of my old-time friends have passed away. But it's just that simple thing of respect and is what people should, and respect the workers out there, those first responders, you know, like people are just, it's really weird the world we live in. It's very... very selfish.
I can't even put it into words how it is when you think about this is our reality. After 9/11 was the last big thing that happened that maybe made us all take a pause and think about just everything in general. But that really lasted, at least outside of New York, maybe a couple of weeks. You know, we really didn't have planes in the air. There was a lot less people on the road. Some jobs had shut down for a couple of days. But this is now. This has never happened in our lifetime.
Yeah, I remember 9/11 clear. I was there. You know what I mean? I'm one of those lucky characters that lived in New York City during 9/11. I'm not really lucky. And I was also living in the UK in London during those terrorist attacks too. And they were both pretty damn scary, especially, you know, the weird thing about New York is when they opened up the airports again and flights were happening again, every time a plane would go by, you would see so many people just looking up in the air. Like, you know what I mean? Like now you probably walk around New York City and there's a plane flying. Nobody even looks up in the air anymore. Slight fear was still there no matter what. A month or 2 months into it, you know what I mean? And I remember, like, within a month of that, all that happened. It was an awful other accident that happened in the right off of JFK took off with a flight, and the plane exploded in the air, and people were on a beach, and they watch it come down, and they thought that was another attack right afterwards, and that was just another freak accident, like immediately afterwards. You know what I mean? So it was definitely alarming. And what we're going through today is who knows? Who knows what the outcome is? Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what the agendas are? Who knows anything? Just living in the now, and we're trying to see where it leads us to, if you know what I mean. But, you know, I like to question everything. I like to figure things out as I see it go along. I'm not going to sit here and be a blind sheep and led into whatever they want. Well, you know, anybody lead me into, I'm going to always question everything before I act.
What was the rest of the year looking like before the pandemic caused everything to stop?
Well, we just released a brand new record. It's called Get Loud. And we're just about to start touring it. And the U.S. was going to start in April, which it's not happening right now. And it was a tour with Sick of It All. And guest, Scarhead was on that too. And then we were going to go right to Europe to do a bunch of festivals June to July, which I heard today, those are canceled now. And then we were, and it's still happening, we think, we hope, we don't know, the October run of the same Sick of It All Agnostic Front Tour is supposed to happen on the West Coast. And then we're supposed to go back to Europe in October. So what's happening now is the April tour has been moved to August. We lost some dates because, you know, everybody's scrambling to try to make shows happen. Then again, we don't know what's going to happen, you know? So now the rest of my year is looking a little bit congested if it happens. It looks like I'm going to be in August right into September, doing all of America with Sick of It All, pretty much. 1 week break in between. And then follow that up right away with Europe. And then I come back, and I think they were trying to fill in Texas and Florida dates that were missing. So the rest of, if everything goes back to how normal, which, you know, you gotta question a lot of stuff, you don't know. If everything does come August, I'll be busy for the rest of the year. So I might as well enjoy whatever free time I got right now home.
Are you still involved with your restoration on vehicles? You still doing that?
Yeah, that's just a hobby. I did that for myself. I'm still part of my car club, Rumblers. Car club, Rumblers CC. It's just a straight up hobby. Normally, when I'm home, I do electrical work, and I work with Mike Oxley over here, Oxley's Electric, and there's plenty of work there for me. He's always says, "Hey, whenever you're ready, you know, come on in." But he knows my situation with my son and my daughter, and he knows I can't really be out right now because, you know, he doesn't want anything to interfere with my personal life here at home. So it's just everything is at halt right now to see what happens.
I remember you were redoing a squat, or you were, you know, setting one up on the Lower East Side, and I went over there one day, and you were doing all kinds of just crazy work on that building. What was some of the skills that you had to teach yourself in that you became really good at? I would imagine electrician is one of them.
Exactly. I got that skill on my all expense government paid vacation. That was one benefit out of that, you know. I've always worked construction, so framing, building walls. I've always been a guy who works with my hands, you know. I did all that. I was also a Harley Davidson mechanic. I worked for Harley Davidson for many years. I think I like working with my hands, you know. I don't know. I can't really sit behind a computer, and I think I'd rather be out there pulling a wire or building a wall or wrenching out a bike or a car, you know. Or at home right now, we're doing, me and my wife, is we have training mats here, and we're just doing jiu-jitsu all day and have fun, you know.
Oh, that's right. Did someone just get a new belt in your family? Was it one of your kids or was it your wife?
My kids just got their orange belts. But they're, you know, they've been, well, Desi's been training since 4 and Abby was 6. Basically, the last belt they could ever collect till they're 16 is the green. So they only have like 2 more and they're still young. And then they move into the regular journey of your blue belt, and now I'm blue, purple, brown, and black. Myself and my wife, we're still in our blue belts, but we've been studying a really strict curriculum, which is pretty tough and kind of mastering certain techniques under the Blue Belt curriculum. So that's where we're at, which is called BBS2 right now. So we're having fun training that in jiu-jitsu in the school that we train at, which is Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, part of the Gracie University. The whole curriculum for jiu-jitsu, and it's entirely from your white belt into your black belt, all 660 techniques are pretty much given to you at your blue belt career, you know what I mean, or where you're at. The rest of it, you master. So we're learning everything that would be our journey into our black belt right now and trying to master it a little bit further, which is what we'll be using for purple, brown, and black a little bit later down the line, if we get that far. I'm pretty sure my wife will. She's very smart. She's also a certified instructor here at Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Phoenix. She's very smart, very, very talented. She trains, also does a women empowered program, which helps a lot of women out. And she teaches the kids and teaches a regular program too. And, you know, I'm always traveling. So how far I get, I don't know, but I'm doing good. I'm hanging in there, man. I'm hanging in there.
Have you ever had to break up a scuffle between the kids and they're using their, you know, it's not just a typical kid fight. Maybe it's a little bit more, or are they pretty much subdued with that sort of thing?
My kids are little angels, man. They don't fight. They really don't. They, if anything, a couple of verbal disagreements. They know better than getting into any type of brawl in that kind of a sense. Plus, the training that they receive, they're really only supposed to use their training, you know, at self defense, pretty much. And it's, I think, a simplify ain't gonna justify that. It's also the last means of their what they call, they have like, I forgot the curriculum, where they have to, you know, they don't want to use it if they don't have to. It's really a gentle art, and it's not about hurting anyone else. It's about being capable of defending yourself if need to defend yourself. That being said, my daughter has a nasty, nasty arm bar. She could do a really great choke. And so my son's got a sick choke too. He'll climb up your back and choke you out pretty quick. But they can do what they got to do.
Do you miss living in the city, or are you pretty happy? I mean, I know you're happy in Arizona, but do you miss one at all, or when you're not there?
Well, you know, the city's not the same city that I miss, that I loved. You know, it's not my party anymore. Like, there was a time and a place, and I just felt like that time and place is just, it's been so gentrified, and it's really not many families living there anymore. All those aspects are kind of gone, you know, or pushed out to farther suburbs, you know what I mean? Like, there's no more families living in Little Italy or Lower East Side. It's all like high rent. Who can afford that anymore? It used to be real genuine families, you know what I mean? Like, you knew everybody in the building, and that's all gone, you know? So, I mean, it is what it is. It's just not my party anymore. I like to go visit. And there's always fantastic food in New York, and I've got friends here, of course. But I'd rather be where I'm at now. I love it here. I love visiting New York City. I hate that they got bike paths there now, and all these rules are now. Yeah, you know what I mean. But anyway, you know, you miss certain things. But even the clubs are all gone. Like, what's there to miss? You know. Like, people move in and they're like, oh, you know, CBGBs is too loud. Did you not know CBGBs has been there for days before you moved in across the street? And, you know, stuff like that. And then, look, that's gone now. And all these venues and all these classic bars are all gone because of noise. Like if it just happened, you know what I mean? So it's not the same.
That's very true. I saw CBGBs, or, you know, the old CBGBs. One day, I happened to be in New York. I haven't been back. You know, I lived on the East Coast, but I never went to New York because I really didn't have a reason to. But I saw it, and I'm just like, this sucks.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't think there's any New Yorkers in New York. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's from everywhere else but New York. Like, everybody's from, NYU. NYU bought everything up. Everybody's there for NYU. So it's like, where isn't a true New Yorker anymore? They're all the way out in suburbs. They're out in the Bronx. They're out in Queens. Not even in Brooklyn. They're getting pushed out of Brooklyn. They're out in Staten Island. And it's just, it ain't, like, let's just say I miss the old New York.
I do as well. And that song was perfect. The one that you wrote. The video was great. With everyone on the subway, and just it was awesome. It was awesome, and also just kind of sad in a way.
That was done guerrilla style, man. We just took over this. We had a bunch of people running, set up real quick, and in between stops up in the Bronx, we were doing it. And people would walk in, the doors are closed, and we start doing it. The doors are open, like we'd be sitting there like nothing happened, and we start doing it, and a couple of people randomly took out their phones and they were videotaping. They probably didn't even know what band it was or what was going on, but it was kind of fun to do that, you know, ride the train all the way down one end back to the other end, just performing, you know.
No, that's great. That's a great story too, because I kind of wondered how you figured that, how you got that done.
Yeah, you know, we wouldn't have gotten no permit or nothing.
Just a lot of, you'd probably still be waiting for the permit all these years later.
Exactly.
Well, Roger, I thank you for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation. And if you had any last thoughts or anything you'd like to say to wrap it up, please do so.
Well, I mean, thank you for the interview. Thank you for the time. It was fun. It was fun. I had a good time. We got to talk about some stuff. Got me out of the regular day that I've been going through here. And I forgot to ask you. You're the one that's posting up all those police chases, right?
Yeah.
I see them all the time. I'm like, look at that. Like every time I go on Facebook, there's some kind of crazy police chase, helicopter chase. That's you, right?
Yes, it is, and I'll tell you why. Well, you just had one in Phoenix, actually. There was a guy in a smart car, of all things, running away from the cops just the day before yesterday. Maybe it was yesterday.
Okay.
Because they're just funny. They're just very indicative to Southern California. They're very native to Southern California.
I think they do it for fame, because you're going to get caught.
Yeah, totally. I mean, OJ started it, and it's kind of funny because it was a slow speed chase. But people outside of Southern California or outside of the southern part of the United States, they don't really have these sort of things. Like, think about it. New York, there's too many buildings around. They couldn't really follow a police chase because they couldn't really get very far. Helicopters wouldn't be able to really follow them through the city. So somehow they just started happening out here over the years, thanks to OJ, and some have gotten really good and just ridiculous. And so I just started to broadcast them over Facebook because I thought it was funny, and people just don't know what to think of it. But then they seem to like them, but I have no control over
it. I see them all the time. Just wanted to let you know.